coming to you from the Independent Media Center here at Media Alliance, the last day during the National Association of Broadcasters Conference. Sitting in the room with Peter Frank, Luke Hyken, and Alan Korn, and we're here to discuss different issues surrounding the micro radio or low power FM movement. So could we start off by you guys kind of introducing yourselves, telling us what your involvement has been and some of the specific cases you've been involved in?
I'm Peter Frank with the Lawyers Guild Center for Democratic Communications. Way back in 1988, I got an email, an old DOS email, from a professor I never heard of at a college I never heard of, saying his friend was in trouble with the FCC. And he had a friend who'd been broadcasting with 1 watt of power, and suddenly the FCC was coming down on him. And that got our committee, the Lawyers Guild, interested in the whole question of micro radio.
Actually, I kind of came in after Luke. Why don't you have Luke?
Well, I've been active in various lawyers guild committees and subcommittees, but one of the things that became just crucial was the whole issue of the monopolization of the media and the fact that in virtually every struggle that the people we represented were involved in, we no longer ever got decent, honest media, whether it was television or newspaper or radio. No matter what was going on, it was either silenced or distorted. And I think those of us who are activists felt it was necessary to try to deal with communications itself. And that's when the Guild's Committee for Democratic Communications was formed around the issues Peter was describing.
And I hooked up with Luke and Peter when I was in law school. I came out of a background of being in independent music and a DJ and having a degree in media issues. So I was in law school and wanted to find an avenue and had a long-standing interest in pirate radio and hooked up with them and began to discuss the issue of low-power FM radio, which used to be legal back when I was a DJ in 1978, Class D stations, and using that as a focus to bring to bear the sort of media critique of consolidation of media ownership and also do something that was empowering and enabled communities to get on the air and fight back.
So I want to spend a lot of time today talking about what's happening right now and where people can go from here, but obviously that has a lot to do with the historical context of where we've come. So wondering if you all could speak about how micro radio has moved from an underground movement with a small number of legal cases to a national movement that is now one of the biggest issues in telecommunications.
Well, I think one of the important factors was that when Free Radio Berkeley went on the air, because Stephen Dunifer knew that the people in the Bay Area weren't getting the news about what was going on in the Gulf War, Luke Hyken took the case and had an initial early victory in persuading a federal judge not to enjoin him from broadcasting, even though everybody admitted he didn't have a license and the law says you're supposed to have a license. The judge said that the free speech and constitutional law arguments, which Alan had first researched while he was actually still in law school, raised serious free speech questions, and that was important, I think, in giving people the feeling that they weren't pirates in the sense of stealing the airwaves, but that they were exercising their First Amendment free speech rights, and that was one of the factors that helped the movement grow.
I think the issue also in terms of the importance of radio was sort of a process in our learning its importance. I mean, most Americans tend to think that they get the news from television or a newspaper. The reality is those tend to be sound bites. And as we started working with radio, what we realized was, especially throughout the world, radio is the primary means of communication. So that when you're talking about revolutionary struggles and activism around the world, what you will notice is control of the radio stations is about the first thing that's of concern to whoever is fighting, because everybody can afford to have a little battery-run radio. Nobody owns the televisions or the newspapers, so that it's always been a controlled and filtered resource for information. But radio is a technology, especially with the machinery that Stephen was able to prepare and produce, that for a few hundred dollars, people anywhere in the world could set up their own community radio station. And watching that process and how it involved sometimes hundreds of people in a community working to put out that radio station and other people listening and participating was really an enlightening process to watch.
I just want to agree with that. The more we became involved in working with stations and we saw the amount of energy that went into producing programming and the amount of support and energy in the community around these stations, I think that's when we really saw the tangible, real life kind of energy and potential these stations produce.
One of the real ironies of this is Luke and I were sharing in the same office suite at the time, and I think on the very day that he got one of the orders from the FCC assessing Dunifer a $20,000 fine over our fax, because Dunifer didn't have a fax at that time, came an order from UNESCO, United Nations Education, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, for $5,000 worth of radio kits from Dunifer that they were going to put out into third world communities. So UNESCO understood how important this technology and this communication was while the U.S. government was trying to shut it down.
Luke, could you maybe speak a bit to, for those people who, out in the audience that might not be too much aware with the Dunifer case, kind of talk about how it came about in the process?
Well, you know, in almost every area of law where people themselves are trying to get some rights that have never really been exercised, what you find is that there are no lawyers that really know that area of law. When the war in Vietnam broke out, the numbers of people that knew draft law and selective service law were almost non-existent, and by the end of the war, there were thousands of people that knew it. In our case, it was relevant that the initial research done by Alan Korn was crucial. Other research on the particular case that I was working on was done by a young attorney by the name of Alan Hopper. Neither of them had any FCC experience. Peter and I were not lawyers who had ever done FCC law, and when we looked around for the resources and the people who knew how to take on the issues we were taking on, there were zero lawyers around the country representing low-power frequency people who were just saying, we have a right to speak over the airwaves too. So that we had to, in fact, create that body of law amongst ourselves. And I think that the reason that the movement steamrolled the way it did when the court looked at these issues and said, well, you're right, of course the airwaves belong to the people. She had no understanding of why it was and what the procedural process was whereby the American people had become voiceless and had been cut off totally from control over their own speech outside of their living rooms or in the local park.
I see you're referring to the judge.
I'm referring to the judge. But what we were saying was so obviously true that I think, not being a player in the game, she didn't realize, no, you're not supposed to allow anyone but the NAB and its constituents to talk.
Well, the fact that this was a judge from Berkeley, maybe, it makes it much different from all the other cases where these were judges in Washington, D.C. We were able to get a judge outside of, at least initially, outside of the Beltway and the jurisdiction of Washington to look at this in a framework, you know, where they're maybe not looking with this absolute deference, like the FCC attorney said at the hearing. It's like, Your Honor, ever since you were a little child, we've been doing it this way. And she wasn't persuaded by that.
When the initial brief that our committee worked on was put together, it was put together with the view of assisting Mbana Kantako in Springfield, Illinois. Broadcasting out of the Hayes homes, he could speak to about 95% of the African-American community because it was such a ghettoized community. And when we talked to him about arguing for the legality of it, his position was, they have no right whatsoever to regulate my speech. I'm not going to go into court and give them that legitimacy. And when we spoke with Stephen, his position was, I'm perfectly willing to go into court to the extent that the courts are willing to acknowledge that I have a right to broadcast. I'm certainly not willing to allow the courts to take away that right. And across the country, there are literally thousands of people who have now gone on the air without licenses, seen how important it is to have their own voice, to have people in the community that are participating in it. And while many of them are perfectly willing to try to get licenses and to go through that process, especially if they want the opportunity to go into court to do so, there are equal numbers or more who are going to say, we're going to go on the air. You know, just the way you can't tell us not to go into the public parks because some corporation bought it and now we have to stay in our homes. Same way people say, the airwaves are ours. If you're going to regulate them and say that they've been bought and sold by these billionaire defense contractors like Westinghouse and General Electric, they're the ones that own ABC and NBC and CBS. People are saying, that's fine for them to do that, but we have a right to broadcast too. Either give it to us or we'll do it illegally.
It was a classic case of civil disobedience. There were 1,000 stations on the air about at the peak, and while they were able to shut down a whole lot of them, others were springing up.
I know recently the FCC has passed legislation that would enable 700 new stations to receive a license.
700 to 1,000, we think.
Okay. But I've also heard some describe this as a scheme. And how do you all respond to this new legislation?
Well, lay out the facts first. The FCC, about 2.5 years ago, started a rulemaking proceeding where they asked for comments on whether they should change the rules. Then they put out a set of proposed rules, and there was a very formal comment period. That's the way government agencies, regulatory agencies, make rules. After a long process, which we and many other organizations participated, in fact, they got more comments on this proceeding than on any other. You know, usually it's these high-priced lawyers in Washington, the phone companies fighting the networks. And this was, I don't know, 30,000 comments they got. In January of this year, they issued rules legalizing, saying they were going to license low-power stations, 10 and 100 watts. Intimidated by the National Association of Broadcasters, they were very cautious about frequency separations. The result is that currently it's almost impossible to find frequencies in the densely populated metropolitan areas. So they're starting the licensing process, and we can talk a little later on how to apply. At the same time, there's a threat from the Republicans in Congress and some Democrats because the National Association of Broadcasters and National Public Radio have been pushing very hard for a law in Congress that will shut the whole low-power radio thing down again.
Who is applying for these new licensees right now?
Yeah, well, right now about there have been two filing windows.
What's a filing window?
A filing window is 10 states have been allotted every 3 months, 10 states, non-contiguous states, but 10 states are provide the opportunity, the groups in those states, to apply for a 100-watt low-power FM license currently. There have been two filing windows, so 20 states of applicants. About 50% of those are religious organizations. A lot of these were perhaps religious organizations that fought against this. So really we need to do a lot of outreach to progressive organizations, grassroots groups, minorities that maybe don't know about this or feel like it's not happening because there's a fight in Congress right now. You know, a lot of these religious groups are very well organized and they have engineers on staff ready to take advantage of these, you know, hard-fought gains that, you know, there were some church groups that have always broadcast illegally too. You know, not to diss them, but a lot of this was largely, you know, progressive organizations and disenfranchised groups. You know, there's a lot of distrust of the government, but, you know, at the same time, I think people should engage in civil disobedience and go on the air, you know, if they feel the need to. I think groups should also try, if there's this opportunity, and it's a very limited opportunity, to apply for the licenses that are now available. This chance might not come again.
Mm-hmm. It's clear from the court decision in the Dunifer case, as well as virtually all of the decisions that have now come down around the country, that if people intend to go into court to challenge the denial of access to the airwaves, they should file a license and request waivers for those portions of the license application that they can't or won't fill out. Because if you don't go through that process, you then are going to get told by the court, well, you procedurally didn't pursue all these other remedies, and therefore you can't come in and ask us for relief. I mean, that's what we have spent the last 6 or 7 years fighting. There has still never been a court decision on the issue of whether or not the FCC has a right to give the airwaves away to the richest corporations in the country and deny licenses to the American people. Yeah, when they were about to be confronted with that, they then acknowledged that they should legalize micro radio, and that's the status. There are no decisions yet on the merits. And so if people want the opportunity to challenge it, they're going to have to file a license as a prerequisite. But those who aren't interested in going into court really have no reason whatsoever to do it.
Mm-hmm. I put it a little bit differently. If you're going to go on and want to defend yourself in court, then you have to have applied for a license and ask the FCC to waive those things that you don't qualify for.
It sounds like, as Adam was saying, there needs to be a lot of outreach right now so that people, maybe some of these more progressive groups, can understand the whole process and opportunity that's out there.
Well, there are groups. There's Prometheus Radio Project, which is, they have a website, prometheus.tao.ca, and we do, the National Lawyers Guild has the website, www.nlgcdc.org. And there's other websites, as microradio.org, people can go to and educate themselves on what they need to do to, it's a very simple license application. It's about 4 pages, a small engineering thing. You know, we have resources we can make available to people if they want to contact us, and we can put them in touch with engineers.
The reality still, though, is that there are thousands of people throughout this nation who are never going to be able to go through the licensing process because they don't have the money to file the applications, even though you can seek waivers on that. They're not going to have people to figure out engineering studies. There will be thousands of people, and our hope is that they recognize that the airwaves still belong to them, and that while we urge them to go through that licensing process if they can, it is very important that people figure out ways to keep their own voice on the radio and on the airwaves. And we would certainly hope that this positive step taken by the FCC of acknowledging the rights of the people to have licenses doesn't end up marginalizing those voices to the point where one out of 99 stations on the air are not wealthy broadcasters.
At the same time, I'd add that people shouldn't be deterred from going through the process for financial reasons. There is help, legal and engineering help for groups that want to apply, where it can be really done in a pretty economical way. I think the place where it's important for people to keep going forward is especially in the areas where no frequencies are available under current standards.
I think it's important to remember that there is no fee, actually, for applying for these low-power FM licenses, too. The costs are typically for attorneys and such, but again, we have the legal resources available and how to sort of pamphlets available on the website to help people just get through this even without a lawyer if necessary.
Mm-hmm. People should also can also educate themselves by looking at the FCC's own website, fcc.gov. If they look at that page and go to the lower right, there's a low-power FM section where a lot of the forms are available and other information is available.
I also wanted to bring up the issue of NPR. There's not a lot of mainstream knowledge over NPR's involvement in micro radio.
Or their involvement in trying to suppress micro radio.
Exactly.
NPR has been opposed to it from the beginning. People from the inside have told us that at the very beginning, when the FCC, when it was clear the FCC was going to do something, there was a deal made between the NPR and the National Association of Broadcasters at the NAB that the NAB would carry the opposition at first because the NPR didn't want to lose their good guy image. After the point where they, where the bills started being put in Congress and it looked like micro radio had good support, NPR came out of the closet literally and started very strongly campaigning for bills that would kill micro radio in Congress. But again, people on the inside, and this makes total sense, say that because they have pushed the NPR stations to do so much national programming and there's so little local programming, they're scared to death of losing audience because micro stations are by their nature going to do local programming. NPR has confused a lot of wishy-washy liberals in Congress who think, well, if NPR has confused a lot of wishy-washy liberals in Congress who think, well, if NPR is against it, they must be sincere. All I can say is NPR is run by a man whose whole career was with Voice of America and Radio Marti, and he seems to be keeping that sensibility in his present job, trying to kill this local medium. Lots of people we talk to who work in NPR are totally for us. Yesterday we made a presentation to the NPR board why they should back off of their opposition.
Board of directors. I'm sorry. It was the board of directors of National Public Radio we were talking to.
One of the people who made a very strong presentation was the union steward from the local NPR station, KQED. So in the ranks and file of the working people in NPR, there's a lot of support for it. But the bureaucrats at the top are really trying to kill it because they're scared it's going to show. Not only are they going to lose audience, but as soon as you hear a micro station, you hear a freshness and a liveliness and aliveness that you don't hear in any other radio in the United States, and the contrast is deadly to an NPR station. I think they're as worried about that as anything else.
This is the same NPR that's trying to suppress, you know, the tapes of Mumia Abu-Jamal that were commissioned for his commentaries on death row. You know, I think they're scared shitless, to use a word that, you know, you didn't want to say, of having a certain oppositional, you know, speaking truth to power, and they understand that micro radio can do that, and it's going to attract not only, you know, disenfranchised voices, but local voices. I mean, radio is a local medium by nature, and by being national, NPR cannot, you know, provide local emergency coverage, coverage of local events, and coverage of oppositional politics. NPR definitely works within the framework of, you know, the sort of the conservative view and the ultra-conservative view, even under the guise of public or liberal radio.
I'd pursue that in a different angle as well. I mean, NPR still has the Mumia tapes that they've never released. I mean, they have stuff that the whole nation wants to hear that they won't release. But more importantly, what I would do is contrast what low-power FM stations and micro-radio stations are about, even with a good station that's not involved in that kind of censorship, such as Pacific and KPFA. It's very different to have programmers who are speaking on behalf of communities that themselves have no voice, and having people speak themselves. I mean, when you look at the thousands of stations that went up around the country, you had Radio Watson in Vacaville, a station of Spanish-speaking people in a community that's 95% Spanish-speaking, in which there is no local Spanish-speaking radio station. You had in Seattle a Korean station for a community of 100,000 people, 50,000 of whom were monolingual Korean, and the only station they had was out of Los Angeles. You had KIND in San Marcos, Texas, locked in between Austin, Houston, and Dallas with no community radio whatsoever, and it was a station that everybody from the city council to the police department to the mayor to everybody in that city used that radio station as a vehicle for communicating. And when you hear people speaking with their own voices, whether it's artistic and cultural or whether it's political, or the variety of stations are very different from an NPR or a Pacifica station. They're just totally different concepts. Mm-hmm. And the idea of people coming in and out of the community to speak and participate in the radio is just simply something that's not available over any of the NPR or Pacifica stations. And that, to me, is the importance of what the community radio provides. That's why in Chiapas, they want Dunifer's transmitters so that they can speak to each other in a community and talk about the politics.
And they have them.
Haiti came and got people to go down to Haiti and train them on how to use community radio so that these massive billionaire corporations couldn't control the airwaves and propagandize. In the Philippines, there are people using micro radio. In nations all over the world, micro radio has been the vehicle for people communicating in their own voice. And, you know, for all the good that NPR and Pacifica and those stations do, they still are speaking for other people, and they're putting forth a sort of a viewpoint that's quite different than the plurality of voices that we really want to hear on the airwaves.
Mm-hmm. Another big change going on right now is a transition to digital radio. So how does that affect the LPFM movement?
Yeah, I'll respond to that. I mean, there's been a huge giveaway of digital spectrum to television, and that kind of went on without the public's real knowledge or understanding, probably because the people who were in the position to tell the public about that were the media, who were profiting most from the digital giveaway. I mean, Bob Dole and John McCain were opposed to it, but only because they wanted to get more money. You know, all the cellular telephone companies, pager companies are paying millions and millions and millions of dollars for the spectrum that was being given away for free to the television. Well, they're about to do that now for radio. In fact, most people will have to turn in their old analog radio receivers and buy new digital radio receivers. These people, you know, it's kind of been going on at the FCC. There hasn't been a lot of public input. We've tried to give some input to it. But, you know, again, with digital radio, there's the potential to designate 25 or 50% of the spectrum as a set-aside for community groups, for non-commercial groups, public nonprofit groups. But that's not happening. You have a digital proposal for something called in-band on-channel, which is entirely different from another format for digital broadcasting that the rest of the world has adopted, which would basically do the same thing, whereby radio is given a certain amount of digital signal, but it's going to be there's going to be a transition period on the analog spectrum, and probably what will happen instead of this high fidelity CD quality audio that you'll get, which you probably don't really need in your car or wherever you're going to listen to radio, where there's background noise, is these existing radio stations, the incumbents, will take these digital signals and separate them down into sort of more low fidelity channels, but have seven or eight different channels where they can sell you different things. Say, you know, if you want to buy this CD, you know, press here, give you a little shot of the CD cover, or sell that bandwidth to other cellular companies, pager companies. Again, digital radio is just another big giveaway, and I think people need to organize. And that was happening here during the weekend of protests against the National Association of Broadcasters, organizing for set-asides on digital spectrum to make sure that community groups can still have a voice on the airwaves in the future, in this next century.
You know, it was always amusing to us that the NAB was characterizing the low-power FM stations as the pirates. And to us, the pirates were always the NAB and its constituents that had stolen the airwaves from the American people. You know, I mean, my feeling is they are, they're such a bunch of gangsters, they ought to be charged with RICO violations. You know, they not only steal the airwaves from the American people, but the NAB lobbyist was sitting in Newt Gingrich's office writing the Telecommunications Act of 1996, giving those very same people free airspace worth approximately $70 to $90 billion, according to Dole and McCain and those people. I mean, who are the pirates and who are the thieves? I mean, really, this is public airspace. I mean, the American people have just been snookered. It's that obvious.
I think it's important to see this whole movement for micro radios in the context of what is, there's a broader movement for dealing with the whole issue of the media going on in this country. In Chicago, there was just a conference put on by Chicago Media Watch called While We Are Sleeping, We Lost Our First Amendment Rights. There's several more conferences coming up. Bob McChesney's book, Rich Media, Poor Democracy, is selling like hotcakes. There's a lot of action here, and the issue is really on the agenda. And micro radio gets new voices on the air, but also sort of opens up some space so that people can take other approaches to the issue.
The last legal aspect I really want to touch on is the Oxley bill, which I believe was created into the Dingell Amendment. And how did this get started, and what did this do?
Well, there's a, you know, there's a saying that you don't want to eat sausage if you watch it being made, and that's sure true about legislation. Oxley introduced a bill that would have killed all micro radio. Congressman Dingell, who's one of the most powerful people in the House of Representatives, made a, quote, compromise that was really designed to save face for these guys, would have resulted in maybe 70 stations going on the air instead of 1,000. And that was passed by the House. It would allow people to say to their constituents, well, we didn't vote to kill it, we just voted a modification. They did this by Congress saying how many steps away on the dial stations should be from each other, which is micromanaging, no pun slightly intended, to an extreme. Those bills are now pending in the Senate, United States Senate, and the reality is there's various formats of the bills, but any bill passed right now by this Congress will, in effect, kill micro radio. And people should really, and it really is hanging in the balance in the United States Senate, people should really write to their senators and have any organization they're part of pass resolutions and write to their senators.
I just wanted to make one comment about the insidious nature of these groups and organizations and institutions, because it's stuff that I did not realize when I started doing this kind of work. Historically, the NAB and the FCC have been a revolving door, much the way the Pentagon and the defense industry is. You go from being a general to being a defense contractor and back and forth. And this is one of the few splits in the history of the FCC and the NAB where the FCC has approved low power and the NAB is trying to kill it. But when you look at these institutions like Westinghouse and General Electric, they are billionaire corporations. The ability of local politicians to try to get elected without the support of the NAB and its media stations is almost non-existent. So you've got this captive audience in the Congress that really requires massive attention if the people are going to overcome the power and the might of these corporations. And in that context, when you look at the fact that historically there have been virtually no splits between the NAB and the FCC, you just realize kind of where the politicians fall in that spread. And that to the extent that the airwaves belong to the American people and have never been granted to them without people engaging in, whether you call it civil disobedience or engaging in their rights to speak over the public airwaves, I think it places in context the need for people to recognize that that's their right. And if the Congress wants to acknowledge that, fine. It's very important to give Congress the chance and the ability to give the people access to their own airwaves. But if they don't, people have got to take them.
You know, I've met with the NAB twice during the rulemaking process, and I tried to tell them there's going to be micro radio and that they're cutting off the nose to spite their face, because if there's enough, if the rules are made so everybody who reasonably wants to and can go on the air, then everybody, all the stations know where each other are, and it's an orderly system. If it's all squelched, there's going to be micro radio, and they won't have any idea where they're popping up.
Yeah, I think this whole micro radio movement, it sort of ties into the whole anti-corporate, anti-globalization efforts that have, you know, really been acknowledged, you know, by the public with the protests of Seattle and around the world. I mean, the whole problem is global corporate control of our minds, of our consciousness. You know, like Wim Wenders' movie guy said, you know, the Yanks have colonized our unconscious. It's these corporations that we're doing battle with on all the other fronts that are the same corporations, like Luke said, that we're doing battle with on the micro front. I mean, it all ties together, and I think it's as people understand that, they get a better sense of the forces that are controlling our discourse, our society, our economy, and where the battles need to be waged. This is a battle for our minds.
Yeah.
But just the way the WTO will never be invisible again, so will the NAB, that has always been an organization that has functioned with anonymity and with secrecy. It will never be invisible again. People see what it's doing. People understand the means it's using to take their voices away. And they're going to have a hard time.
You know, at the root of all this is the nature of our media system. You know, recent scholarship has resurfaced the fact that in the late 20s there was a battle royal over whether the media system would be commercially based or non-commercially based. And it only lost by a few votes in Congress that it would be non-commercially based. And people have to realize that we're going to have to change that and reclaim a big part of the spectrum in order to change this. And this is the first step. Sort of the micro radio is the camel's nose under the tent of commercial broadcasting.
I think there definitely may be some inspired and moved people out in the audience that might be thinking, well, hey, I might very well want to engage in my right to express myself. Where do people begin? What kind of resources are out there? What is the investment that's involved?
If they want to go the licensing route, they can put the hardware together for between $500 and $2,000 to get on the air. There's a number of web pages that Alan mentioned before. They can go to our web page. We'll get them to a lot of the others, and we'll get them a lot of the information about when the remaining 3/5 states can apply and help for applying. And our web page is www.nlgcdc.org. for National Lawyers Guild Center on Democratic Communications.org. So that's one place to start if they're going to go the licensing route.
The technology that Stephen made available in terms of low-power transmitters that can be hooked up for very little money that can be used in communities anywhere is still available, and it's perfectly legal and legitimate for people to have kits to learn how to do that stuff and to figure out how they could go on the air if, in fact, they were given the opportunity to do so. Now, Stevens sells these kits. The phone number for the Free Radio Berkeley office is 510-549-0732. And people can call and say, please send me information about radio kits and how they work and what are the costs involved. I can tell you that it's possible for people to put a radio station on the air for less than $300 very easily that will never, I mean, in the 6 years that Stephen was lawfully broadcasting, before the court said stop broadcasting, there was never one complaint of interference. That was not, you know, I mean, there were a few that were created by the FCC, but when it was looked into, they had to acknowledge that it was their complaint rather than anybody else's.
And we're sitting in front of a tabletop mixing board you're using for this show, which is about four times as big as a 40-watt micro radio transmitter.
And I think radio production now, for people who are at stations, you know, assuming you get your transmitter up and you want to do radio production, go out into the field, I mean, you know, you can get cassette decks, turntables, whatever, at a Goodwill. But there's even things like Pro Tools now, or little computer-based editing suites that are probably a couple hundred dollars, you know, at most.
And the availability through the, one of the real breakthroughs that didn't exist when we started this was the use of the internet itself for broadcasting and transmitting. I mean, it's incredible to be able to sit and listen live throughout the world to these demonstrations in San Francisco over websites. I mean, it gives people around the world the ability to instantaneously know what really is taking place and not have to wait and listen to what New York or Tokyo or London say is happening. I mean, we can find out from each other rather than having to rely on CBS, NBC, and ABC.
One of the other major resources for training and help getting online, especially in the eastern part of the country, is Prometheus Radio Project, which does tours through the states that are coming up for licensing, both doing training on how to do the station itself and how to go through the application.
They're having on November 17th of this year, 2000, in Appaloosis, Louisiana, they're having a barn raising. It's actually a radio station raising where there's a applicant in Appaloosis that probably will be granted a license from the FCC. And they're going to go out there, and they want people from all over the country to go out there to help build a station, basically, in one day. It would be a great opportunity for people to go out there and see exactly what it takes to build a station. Mm-hmm. And you can go to the Prometheus website and find out more about that.
I mean, you should realize that Stephen broadcast for the first 6 months from a backpack that he was carrying into the Berkeley Hills and transmitting from there. It's not, I mean, people have this sense of, you know, large boxes and complex machinery. It is incredibly simple and easy for people to do. It's a technology that is available to massive numbers of people, not just elites.
I should add, if people want to get in touch with the National Lawyers Guild committee or center itself, we have outreach. And for instance, I can go out to a community where there's a lot of interest in people learning how to apply for a station, and we can try to work together to put together workshops or applications for this. So people should feel free to get in touch. We have a phone number, too. I think it's area 415-522-9814.
All right. Well, we've been talking to Peter Frank, Luke Hyken, and Alan Korn. Appreciate you all coming down, spending some time with us here today, and sharing with the public how they can get involved in some of the context and legal aspects of LPFM micro radio.
Thanks.
Thank you.